Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll, and today we're talking about economics. Economics has always seemed like a funny field to me. I mean, on one hand, it can be extremely mathematical, precise, rigorous theorems are proven. On the other hand, it's extraordinarily relevant to the messiness of everyday life. And there's this ongoing tension between the pristine mathematics and the messiness of reality. Furthermore, in the United States, at least right now, people are wondering about what kind of economics we should have. Of course, capitalism. I don't think it's possible to deny that capitalism has done good things. We have had enormous growth over the last several hundred years. On the other hand, it's also impossible to deny that unchecked capitalism can be extremely deleterious. We need a social safety net, etc. Some people, even here in the U.S., are looking at controlled economies like they have in China with a little bit of envy. There's a lot to be skeptical about in the economic performance of the U.S. right now. On the one hand, the stock market and GDP is growing. On the other hand, we have more inequality than we've had in a long time. On the one hand, unemployment is low, but on the other hand, there's a lack of really good jobs. It's easy to get a job, but not one that really earns you a living wage. So some people are beginning to question the fundamental truths of received economics. Today, I'm talking to Suresh Naidu, who is a professor of economics and international affairs at Columbia University, as well as external professor at Santa Fe Institute. Suresh is not a bomb thrower. He's not trying to overthrow the system or anything, but he's very interested in the relationship of economics to other big picture questions about how societies function. Does democracy promote growth? What was the economic influence of slavery? Can we have equitable economic growth? Is it possible to have booming economic growth while we still have equality and still take care of the people who are not doing well in our society? So we'll go into questions about capitalism, socialism, what's been good, questions about the labor market and inflation and monopsony, as well as monopoly. It's a fascinating little intro to a whole bunch of big topics for people who are not experts in economics, including myself. We are all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Remember to check out our webpage at preposterousuniverse.com/mindscape. One of the things you have to remember is that we have show notes for every episode so you can find links to things. So for example, in today's episodes with Suresh, we're talking about a textbook that he and many other collaborators have been working on, an openly available textbook in economics. You can find a link to that on the webpage. So with that, let's go. Suresh Naidu, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I've been on record as saying that I want to have more economics on the podcast. I talk about lots of things.
My apologies.
That's okay. There's a lot there, but it's a little bit intimidating. I've decided it's intimidating because what I do for a living, you know, dark matter, the origin of the universe, it doesn't affect people's daily lives, right? Their daily bread, their jobs, et cetera. But economics is relentlessly practical in some way. So much economics is not the kind of high abstract theoretical stuff that I love so much, but really down to earth trade and markets and labor and things. What is the division of labor inside economics like that? Is that an accurate representation on my part?
So I would say that like economics does have certain parts of it that are actually really are kind of about describing big and personal forces that wind up constraining or shaping what our everyday lives look like, in the same way that you know, gravity or ecology or, you know, atmospheric pressure is a real thing in our lives, and we don't necessarily understand it all, but what physics and the rigorous study of these things do is let you understand these forces that are just really important in your life. And then, you know, and I think many physicists also think this, that one of the things you learn when you understand these forces is that you get sort of some insight into what are the tools for manipulating them, what are the constraints on those tools, what are the orders of magnitude of scale that you can, like, humans can reasonably move with, mm-hmm. what kinds of instruments. And so I would say at that level of abstraction, it's very similar. Like, there's a bunch of things in economics that are about describing patterns of global trade, macroeconomic forces that are really impersonal, big things that are kind of the aggregated decisions of billions of people showing up. But then one of the benefits of understanding that is that you then understand how, like, okay, well, what is the minimum wage going to do? Or what can central banks do with the interest rate? And what are the places that you have these touch points that you can push a lever or do something and maybe make things a little bit better? And so I think it's, you know, not so far away, I don't think.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Is there the economics equivalent? By the way, do you say economics or economics?
Economics. It depends what country. I don't know.
Okay. Just checking that I wasn't doing a faux pas there. Uh-huh. Is there the equivalent of, you know, string theorists or mathematical physicists who never look at data whatsoever, like never apply their stuff to the real world? Are there purely big brain economists who just work out general principles, or does basically everyone dip their fingers into the muddy waters of reality?
I mean, you must know the answer to that. Yeah. So I mean, as you probably know, like, the whole 20th century of economics was dominated by basically brilliant mathematical theorists.
Yeah.
Everyone from Kenneth Arrow, who was a founder of SFI, of the Santa Fe Institute, and people like Paul Samuelson, and just people whose entire lens on the world was building these incredibly elegant theories that would capture some very deep fundamental truths about the way markets worked, or the way, you know, political institutions could work, or just tools for understanding what it meant to have supply and demand equal to each other. I would say overwhelmingly for the 20th century, economics was in this world where what it meant to do good economics was you built mathematical models. Mm-hmm. And what it meant if you weren't a really good mathematical theorist is that then you went off and, like, did empirical work and looked at the world. But I do think
Not only is there that distinction in economics, but it's the same status hierarchy.
There's a Axel Leon Hundvold. I can never pronounce his name, but he had an article about, like, life among the econs, where he kind of takes, like, an anthropological lens to the economists and sort of say, you know, they have their fetishes, they're called models, and, like, you have the highest caste group who are, like, the manipulators and creators of these models, and so that was really, like, economics, I think, in the 20th century. And then I think what has been a slow but I think positive development is that social scientific data became our microscope and just made it that the starting in, like, the 60s and things, even with the rise of labor market data, like the current population survey, like the individual files of the census and the computational power to process them, it became now a world where you really had to not – it wasn't enough to just have a kind of cute idea about how this theoretical force might work. You actually had to sort of provide some evidence that it mattered. And it also wasn't enough to just sort of say, well, supply equal demand, and that would obviously answer all of these questions, because, you know, it became, like, something that we actually had to look at. Well, how important are these supply and demand forces relative to the background noise that's just going on in society and all these other things? Maybe we're mathematically right, but quantitatively small.
Right.
And that becomes something that we start to look at. So there's both a measurement angle of the rise of government surveys. There's a way in which, like, the operations of government themselves generate so much data, mm-hmm. running a UI system, Social Security, administering in European countries administering like corporatist wage setting between unions and firms. It just like as those processes became more routinized and bureaucratic, they generated a huge volume of data that was then also kind of a great social science microscope.
So it's the big data era, basically.
It's the big data. It's a big data era. I would say like it's a little bit. I mean, you know, in the style of economics that I sort of come out of, we were always using the biggest data sets you could get your hands on. And yes, some things have changed with big data, but in some ways, like a lot of the principles that we had with small data are just, it's just a computational problem. It's not a conceptual problem. I want to say an important part of that is like kind of I think also since the late 90s has been like a real attention to what we'd say is causality and causal identification.
Oh, okay.
So that it wasn't enough to – so basically there was a lot of sort of shoddy work around correlations and saying, oh, see, this correlation shows that this theory is correct, but never – not nearly as much of the kind of paying attention to looking – at the parts of the world that look like they're generating natural experiments,
okay.
Or that there's like where something is just shifted all of a sudden, and then that's like a particularly clean test of a theory. And so basically the rise of this kind of causal revolution in economics really sort of, you know, we also changed how we use data so that we really became attentive that you couldn't just like mine a data set and look for whatever correlations that you wanted. You had to really commit to a design that was like, okay, here's a control group, here's a treatment group, here, let's look at the difference and make sure that those things are comparable on every other dimension.
I'm sure this is a very unfair question, but is there one big lesson that has been learned since we have been paying attention to these big data sets and causality and things like that, or is it many little lessons?
I'd say there's a couple of big lessons, but what you'll think of as big depends on what you kind of care about the
sure.
world. So, like one thing that's kind of been, you know, a lot of papers got written on and kind of like answered the question was just like, what's the rate of return to a year of schooling?
Oh, okay.
And basically, you know, 15 years of trying to estimate that using all sorts of clever things about lotteries and distance to universities and trying to get this kind of experimental variation generates, you know, we roughly get a ballpark number between 9 and 12%. So that's
9 and 12%
in dollar, like in terms of like additional
salary
earnings. Earnings, yeah.
Okay,
another one, though, that's like
That was a difficult thing because, of course, education is correlated with a whole bunch of other
things.
Yeah,
your decision to go to school is correlated with your ability, all of this
and
other
your parents
stuff.
And
your parents and your parents' income and all this stuff. And so finding places where you could actually say, no, sending this person to school increased their earnings by 12%. I think that's a result, and we kind of have that's...
And is that elementary school, high school, college, grad school, any of those?
Places that we have it's a reasonably stable, I think... 12% is in the high school to college range. So that's sort of where at least my familiarity with that evidence kind of lives. But it's sort of held up as a victory in labor economics is that we sort of know that like there's like a positive rate of return to schooling.
Stay in school, kids.
Stay in school, yeah. The other, although not at any price, so there is like it's only
sure,
it's only 12%. The other thing, I mean, which I'm happy to go into because I know a lot about it, is like this endless debates on the minimum wage and how, you know, basically this almost as long as there's been a minimum wage, economists have argued
right.
about whether or not it on net costs jobs, and you know, I wouldn't say that it's like 100% settled now, but I think it's like 80 to 95% settled now,
which is super good in social sciences.
Which is super good, and who knows, it might get overturned. Like we might get a whole new wave of studies that just flip this around. Well, let's see. Particularly as the minimum wage just starts, at some point, it's gonna. If you just keep ratcheting up the minimum wage, I think at some point you start to see disemployment effects. But I think one of the other successes of this kind of causal identification. Turn has been kind of really getting clean estimates of like the lack of let's suppose the minimum wage does kill jobs. If it does, it's a very small number. relative so that, to
that
what
is,
we thought.
The result is that the minimum wage, roughly speaking, doesn't kill jobs.
Doesn't kill very many jobs, if
does
any.
Not cause unemployment.
Yeah. And, you know, so if it, yeah, so, it, you know, you can imagine that like a 10% increase in the minimum wage will cost no more than like 0.1% of jobs.
Okay.
That's is the kind of estimates we're after. And that is something that's incredibly cuts to the core of so many people's priors about what markets are like. You know, because if supply is equal to demand and then you impose a minimum wage, then that has to reduce employment. It's just what the graph says.
Well, I mean, just to put that in other words, saying the same thing, if employees cost more money, you're going to have less of them.
That's – yeah. It's like – and Gary Becker, I think, literally said this. It's like gravity goes the wrong way. And like but I think one of the useful things about this transformation of economics into kind of a much more empirical, much more kind of what we call identification-based discipline has been that we – are able to take things that were just kind of somewhat ideological articles of faith about how markets must work and just
test them. The data, yeah.
And find that, yeah, and often in lots of markets, supply does equal demand.
Yep.
And in some markets, it's more complicated.
I want to pause to talk about Joybird Furniture, because if there's one thing we know about Mindscape listeners, they have style and taste. And when it comes time to buy furniture, the stuff that is out there might not match your unique sense of style. So with Joybird, you can create the kind of style and furniture that you want. You can customize it. You can bring your vision to life with over 50 fabric and leather options, 3 different shades of wood, and over 250 unique silhouettes. You have leather, you have velvet, and you also have a range of kid-friendly and pet-friendly upholstery options, plus a protection plan to keep the pieces looking as great as the day they come into your home. Don't let me forget that there's a 365-day home trial, so you can sit on it, sleep on it, break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, you can return it. So create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/mindscape. See how Joybird can help make your dream space a reality today at joybird.com/mindscape. That will get you an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code Mindscape. I get the impression from not only reading your stuff but other people that economists know the following, that in Econ 101, we teach you that markets are the best and supply and demand control everything. And then in Econ 102 and every subsequent course, all we talk about is how the market fails and how we have to fix it.
Yeah, and then, I mean, there's also Econ 3, which is like how the government's attempting to fix them also
fails.
Then fail. And then there's like Econ 4, which is how like you actually, in order to fix the government failures, you might actually need a specific set of market failures to like anyway. So we can keep going, but I think that's roughly right at first pass. Yeah.
I mean, so if our intuition about why the minimum wage should cause unemployment is wrong, what's right? How should we think about the minimum wage?
So I think this comes to the other thing that's. I want to talk about, which is just that, well, what do labor markets actually look like? And they look like a world in which, particularly at the bottom end, in which employers are not taking the market wage as given, where they have some leeway to choose wages because they have to manage – because workers don't have perfect turnover across jobs. Let me put it a different way. So when I cut my wage by 10% as an employer – what fraction of my workers disappears in the next, say, 1 to 3 years? And, you know, standard economic theory would say 100%. Everyone has to leave instantaneously and it would, you know...
Get a better job elsewhere.
Get a better job elsewhere. But what you see in the data when you actually get those kinds of experiments is roughly like 30%, which is not zero. So it's like the market forces are there.
Yeah.
But it's also not... it's also not like everyone immediately. It's like 30% over a year. It takes a while. And so what that means is that employers have some discretion because they can be like, okay, I can pick a wage that's maybe a little bit lower than I might be willing to pay because I'll save on payroll. I might have to endure a little bit of higher turnover, but it's worth it to me in exchange for what I can save on payroll. And so then if employers are then kind of trading off this wages and turnover, which is very intuitive. If you look at any HR textbook, they, it's kind of what they tell you to – you know, it's like you're worried about turnover. You should think about the wage you're setting. Then that means that one of the things that happens when the minimum wage goes up is that you kind of get – you're forced to raise a higher wage. And so you get lower turnover as a result, and then that like offsets any like additional cost of labor that you might have faced with it faced from the additional minimum wage. So you can think of it this way, like and there's a paper that finds this.
So that was backwards from what we were just talking about, because you were just saying if you lower the wages, people should leave, but they don't, and now you're saying if you raise the wages, the employers won't cut
Sorry,
jobs.
So you're starting from a place where employers have set the wage such that they're enduring a given level of turnover and they're paying a low wage.
Uh-huh.
And so then imagine that the minimum wage comes in and like forces them to pay a higher wage.
Right.
And so then they're like, well, now they have to take that higher wage, but as kind of a byproduct, they get lower turnover.
Okay, yeah.
And so that's why you don't see necessarily so many jobs getting destroyed, is because there's this offsetting force of the lower turnover.
And they were willing to pay that much all along is part of this theory.
Well, no, it's costing them profits.
It's costing them profits.
And they're passing along some of it to consumers, for sure.
Okay.
So both of those things happen, but I think—
There still is supply and demand.
There's still like but one of the things you don't see is this immediate cost in jobs.
Yeah, okay.
Because of this like kind of offset in decreased turnover. And so what you actually see when you can see recruits and quits kind of separately is that you'll see that there's a paper that looked at this in the US that found that new hiring falls, but separations fall the exact same amount.
Hmm.
And so that's why it's kind of a net wash. So you hire fewer new workers, but your existing workers don't quit nearly as much, and so you don't shrink in overall employment.
So in both cases, in the fact that the workers don't leave immediately if their wages are lowered, and the fact that the employers don't hire far fewer people if the minimum wage comes in, there's sort of a stickiness or a friction in sort of physics terms, right? Like there's an ideal system where things work a certain way, but the world is far from ideal. Is that
so
fair?
So yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, so I feel like that is often how we're taught economics, which is that the perfectly competitive, frictionless world is analogous to the ideal gas. It's like this is the thing that, without any other information, you should think that it looks like this, and then you bolt things onto this apparatus in order to make it look more like reality. And so I'm of mixed minds about that. I'm like, yeah, that's a pretty powerful way to work, partly because that perfect competition thing comes with a bunch of like mathematical things that make it really tractable and make it like
things,
and you can communicate it very easily to other economists. Everyone knows what it looks like. So it is very powerful, but for certain things it's also like terribly misleading and such that, and particularly around, I mean, I guess this is just my hobby horse, is that particularly around things around the labor market, but I would also say like the land market and the credit market, like these markets where there's lots of these, it's complicated, that the perfect competition assumption does more violence to the reality than might be acceptable. And we don't yet have a benchmark for that's a substitute for that frictionless world.
Yeah.
So we're still kind of hovering around it. But I feel like there's if you looked at theoretical models now that are even trying to be quantitatively made more accurate, resemble the real world, they have to adopt as baseline measures departures from that frictionless world. So let me give you a concrete example. If you want a world in which there's any kind of role for monetary policy, for example, from the central bank, you need a world in which prices are sort of sticky. And so to get just like as a first pass, these are what are called New Keynesian kind of models, is that you need models where it's where not all firms can adjust all their prices instantaneously.
Yeah.
And so there's like a couple of tricks for getting that. One is like a monopolistic competition and like a staggered price setting. And that's one modeling trick that is kind of becomes almost another benchmark in all of the models that need to talk about kind of monetary policy, because it's really hard to get a role for monetary policy in a model that doesn't have that kind of like friction. So there's like one sort of mini canonical model that talks about that. Let me give you another example.
But the idea is that I mean, your underlying claim is that the very idea of a frictionless model being the good starting point is it's so far away from reality that it's just not even a good starting point.
It's not even a good starting point, or I wonder about it. Like, So
I blame Galileo for all this, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
In physics.
Well,
you know, Galileo overturned Aristotelian physics. You know, two objects, he says, will actually fall at the same rate. And you can do an experiment and drop a rock and a feather and they don't fall at the same rate. And I think that Galileo gets credit for being the first one to say, but they would if it weren't for air resistance, right? And he sort of set the paradigm of physics that let's ignore as much as we can ignore and then put everything back in later.
That's very, very interesting. I hadn't heard it dated back to Galileo.
I'm sure that there's a bit of, you know, selection effect of giving credit to famous people, but, you know, he was synthesizing things that other people did. But I think that paradigm of imagining a world without friction, without dissipation and so forth, and then you can build on that to get the real world, I think Galileo gets as much credit for
it
as anyone.
Got it. Interesting. That's very interesting.
But there's no reason why it has to work where things are strongly coupled and nonlinear like they are in economics.
Yeah. And it's also like it kind of feels like it should depend on the problem that you're trying to solve. Like for some problems, air resistance is the thing that you actually care about.
Exactly. That's right. Yes. There's a whole other limit where you're moving through molasses, not air, which you can't start by assuming it's frictionless.
So that's at least how I think about it. And I also want to point out there's like lots of ways in which this frictionless world, it's not just a theoretical construct. It gets embedded into how do we construct various measures of national income and in government statistics construction. There's like a surprising amount of kind of folk theorizing that goes into even like core economic measurement that you're always like, should we really believe that? And so I just want to like flag that it's not purely theoretical things, it matters for how we actually measure the world.
And closely related to this minimum wage question is the monopsony question,
which is,
right?
I just gave you the short version of that. Yeah.
Exactly, but we can use the technical term here because it's a useful one. I'm sure that everyone's heard of monopoly, where there's one company that has all the products.
Yep.
So what's monopsony?
So first let me clarify. So that monopoly power, I guess, is kind of just considered, you know, it's just that you have some ability to set the price so that you don't have to take the market price as given. You can instead have some control over what price you set.
Okay.
So you're not, if you change the price a little bit, you don't lose all of your customers immediately. It's again like that 30% sort of thing. You'll lose some, but not everyone. And so that's kind of the monopsony is basically the flip side of that for the labor market, where you think about wages, instead of a firm having to take the market wages given, it instead has some discretion to set the wage. So let me give you some and one of the things when they do have this discretion, they can manage it and say, yeah, you know, I'm going to pay a little bit of a lower wage and accept the additional turnover and that same thing I explained a little bit earlier. But let me just give like some very concrete sort of real world evidence for this. So, for example, you can go online, you can find these leaked slides from Walmart's HR program. I was talking about Sam's Club and like how they set pay. And so it turns out one of the things that's very interesting in that is that they talk about how if a Sam's Club needs to set a wage that's really different from the national wage policy, they need to apply to Bentonville, Arkansas for a special exemption.
Okay.
So that suggests that,
That's the headquarters.
Headquarters, yes. Yeah. So that suggests that it's not the case that every Walmart has to like exactly pay the wage in that labor market. There's in fact a national wage policy. Another paper by a co-author of mine and his co-authors, Dubé, Giuliano, and Leonard, was looking at this national retailer that basically had a policy that gave you a raise that depended very discontinuously on your previous wage. So if you were making like one penny over some threshold, you were like got a very different raise than if you were making one penny below.
Okay.
And so what you can do is look to see what happens to quits. Among those, do workers differentially leave just around that based on the change in the raise that they got? Turns out not that many left when they didn't get the same raise relative to those that did, suggesting again that like there's not just a huge responsiveness to the wage in the labor market. But I think what's also evidence about this is also evidence for is that, you know, the very fact that you could have this like weirdo wage raise policy where you had all these like discontinuities in it, is not the kind of thing that you think that comes out of like a smooth market-taking system where you would just have to naturally – it would look like airline prices. We'd have lots of round numbers and things would be like a much smoother distribution. But the fact that when you look at a wage policy and you see all this like bunching and kinking and all of this stuff suggests that there's a real – like room for human decision making.
And isn't there also an information problem? I mean, we have the social more that we don't ask each other what we're getting as a salary, right?
Yeah.
That certainly helps the people setting the salaries.
It does. It does. And there's some very interesting studies on this. By the way, I should flag, you know, there's been a great campaign by coworker.org that's been to make these like kind of online spreadsheets where workplaces can like share their salaries, and that's become like an important like kind of labor organizing tool.
I've actually seen that for science journalists with what magazine rates are.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah,
they're not publicly available, but they're shared.
They're shared. Know, yes.
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's exactly like creating information about what wages are, and there's kind of a great study done by these professors at UC Berkeley. So if you're at Berkeley, wages are public for all public employees.
Yeah.
And so what they did is they actually randomized showing some workers a link to the pay of their coworkers and others not, and looked to see the job search and quit behavior of those that got the ability to compare their wages to their peers. And they find that those that are making below what their peers are making are more likely to leave.
Quit a lot more. Okay, good. Information is power.
So I just think that that's like kind of some immediate evidence that the labor market doesn't look like the market for chairs.
It's not frictionless, right? Okay.
There's not like this law of one price. And another piece of evidence that's sort of come out from this big era of big data is this availability of matched worker firm data. That where you can see like the same worker being employed by different firms over time, and you can see how much of their wage changes depending on what firm that they're at versus who they are. So you can imagine if the labor market was totally frictionless, the wage would just depend on you, not which firm you were at, because all firms should be in the same labor market.
Right. You have an intrinsic worth and they pay it.
And they pay it, yeah, exactly. It's like your human capital captures this, is priced, and every company has to pay the same price for that. So, but what you in fact see is that there's a considerable movement of individual workers' wages. So something between 15 and 20% of the wage variation that we see is explained by the firm that you're at, not just who you are. And so that suggests that given this like reasonably important role for firms, that again, there's like this kind of room for all these frictions, because that's a deviation. So I guess, I don't know if there's an analog in physics for the kind of person that's really obsessed with the frictions versus the kind of person that's really
that's
into the ideal and into the frictionless model.
Right. I mean, you have to be. Some people have to do that. You've probably heard of Peloton. It's a game-changing cardio workout that you can do in the comfort of your own home. And now there's a new way that you can overcome that barrier to getting it done with a 30-day home trial. There's free pickup and full refund. So if you're interested in possibly seeing what life is like with a Peloton bike in your home, you can try it out and see what you think, free for 30 days. Peloton is super convenient. You can use the bike whenever you want. There's a great variety of workouts available. There can be live motivation, right? You can have a live class with a world-class instructor, or you can just do it on your own time. One membership can have profiles for the whole home. So if it's not just you, if there's other people who'll be working out, you can track your progress differently. You can have different preferences and so forth. So try it yourself. Learn more about the 30-day home trial at onepeloton.com. That's onepeloton.com. And get $100 off accessories with the purchase of the Peloton bike if you use the promo code Mindscape. That's onepeloton.com and use promo code Mindscape to get started. Restrictions apply. But so this leads into the real world question of low wage jobs, right? There's been a lot less of rebounding in the low wage sector than the high wage sector since the financial crisis, if I understand correctly. And some people have blamed automation, other people have blamed globalization, and this sort of labor market stickiness is a different explanation.
Yes. So I want to be clear that like a bunch of those other explanations do have like, I'm not going to deny that trade with China has had a huge effect on American jobs, and that's like a big – that is a big factor. Automation, I think it's a little bit premature. I don't know that we have, like, really amazing evidence that automation has really leveled American employment.
Andrew Yang is very worried about it. We know that, right?
Yes, but I feel like it's kind of – I feel like it's this fantasy that, like, American capitalism goes through every, like, couple of generations. It's like in the 60s, it's like, the robots are coming.
Yeah.
And
it seems to be like a perpetual belief that jobs will disappear because of automation.
Yeah.
But it always seems to be true that other jobs – pop up, but maybe that doesn't last forever.
And you know, who knows? I don't know if that's like an iron law or like that. That just might be a law insofar as there's things that humans have a comparative advantage in relative to machines. But I do want to suggest that there's a way in which the you know, and we also want to flag that we're currently at like record low unemployment, like kind of insanely low. Yep. You know. Unemployment, hot labor market, and yet we're seeing that it's really difficult to pick up increases in wages in this period of
which goes against our intuition from Econ 101.
Yes, exactly, and that it goes. It also points against some of the automation and trade stories because it's like a lot of if those stories were the main thing going on, then you would expect it's also you'd see it show up in unemployment as well as wages.
Yeah.
While if it's but if you have really low unemployment. But you're seeing low wage growth. It's kind of like brings you to like kind of a what's a different category of explanation. And so I don't want to say that monopsony is like the only or main thing going on here. I don't know. I do think it is interesting that a lot of the forces that have countervailed monopsony mm-hmm. have just been in slow decline. So like unions. So a lot of the things that took the wage setting power out of the hands of firms have just like over 50, 70 years have just declined. And because of
changes in government policy or just
I would say some of it is changes in government policy. Some of it is these other technology and trade things. So you can imagine a big chunk of the effect of trade is via hammering union manufacturing jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of them were like relocating to right to work states and that got hastened by globalization, and once you have more and more of manufacturing,
for those who don't know, right to work is basically like right to not be in union.
Right to not be in the union, and so just you know between and both like relentless government hostility to unions, particularly since like the 1970s. So you can think of those two things happening together. And so that this erosion of this institution that pushed back against that sort of curbed monopsony, but also made us think that it wasn't a big problem. Which is an interesting history of thought kind of thing that like in the 1940s and 50s, labor economists who were not like the high priests of mathematical theory, but these were the people that were working there were professors at like Harvard and Princeton and Berkeley, and they were also employed in the National War Labor Board to like involved in wage setting, involved in union firm negotiations. And they very much had the idea that the labor market, when it was not regulated, looked like monopsony. And that firms had to consider
idea.
It's an old idea.
Not exactly the new
one. Yeah, I didn't invent it by no means. and it was not invented in the last 20 years. It's like Joan Robinson, who's in my mind the greatest economist of the 20th century. I just want to say that so that more people look up who she is, and she just had a very interesting life.
When was she working?
So in the 1930s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So she was one of Keynes's compatriots in Cambridge, and one of the people in that circle of British economics in like in mid century, and so she comes up with it. She's also one of these economists that partly because of who she is and stuff that's like always like arguing with the Marxists, and so it takes their ideas very seriously, but it's like arguing with them.
Constructive argument.
You can kind of see monopsony as like kind of a sort of somewhat of a genesis of that. Coming out of some of those conversations, when labor economists heard about this theoretical thing, they were like, "Yeah, that's totally right."
Makes sense.
So there's a great quote I love from this paper by Clark Kerr, who's a labor economist in 1950, which is like, "Yes, this theory of like what he called it natural competition, but monopsonistic competition." It might be relevant for like laissez-faire labor markets, but the labor markets of the future are going to be administered and unionized. And so this kind of monopsony thing isn't really a relevant object of study because we're headed to a world where everyone's going to be in a union.
So he thought that the workers would prevent monopsony, basically.
Yes. And so he might have got the effect of unionization on monopsony right, but he got the time trend of unionization totally wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think that's an interesting history of thought, partly also because those old, what they were called institutionalist labor economists, really got the idea that there is kind of a considerable amount of discretion that firms have in wage setting, that it wasn't just like this frictionless supply and demand. They had this idea that there was like a band of wages that, you know, wages could be set around in this band, okay, and that there was considerable leeway within that band.
Yeah.
So that was like a way of adding frictions.
Mm-hmm. Hysteresis or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think, yeah, so how did I... Not sure how I got back to the to those, but I think this point that the labor market is particularly a place where these frictions are important, and so if you really kind of care about studying low wages and labor market outcomes, you kind of need to depart from the frictionless model to get it right.
And is my vague feeling correct that organized labor has just been declining in power for decades?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. It takes a particularly sharp downturn in the early 80s.
Okay.
And some of that's the 81 recession. Some of that is just generic employer hostility. It's something that's actually a paper I'm working on, is kind of just trying to document this change in norms that just seems like you get this, like, all of a sudden this tip in norms among employers, where before they were kind of playing softball with unions. They'd be like, okay, well, you know, you can go out on strike. We won't fire you, even though they had all kinds of legal powers to fight unions with more vigor. They didn't use them just because of the norms against them. And then that just flips in the 70s. They all of a sudden become like, all right, truce is off. We're now going to fire workers during strikes and replace them with permanent replacements.
And the Reagan administration.
And the Reagan administration is just kind of like
along.
A green light to jumpstart that. So I think that's all part of the sauce of what's going on. I don't know that anything. I mean, there's also structural ways in which American and British and Australian unions are organized that makes it hard to imagine how they could come back in the form that they existed, because they're organized on like an enterprise basis rather than on a whole labor market basis. So in Europe, you know, unions are sector wide, and they got everyone's in them, or everyone's at least covered by them. And in the U.S., it's been this like firm by firm kind of organizing model, and that's just a really uphill battle for unions. So I don't know what I don't know that unions are going to come back in the form that they look like. I do think something like them needs to come back to sort of if something that curbs the use of monopsony power by firms needs to like.
Well, I was going to ask: is that your prescription? Is there a best way to fight against this monopsony power?
Yeah. So I do think that like some sort of way of workers getting a substantial voice in how wages are set collectively, and what's important about it's difficult for the government to do it. So the government can impose a minimum wage, but one of the things that the government can't know is exactly what's the mix of wages and benefits that workers want. B, how much of that mix of whatever workers want are consistent with the firm's business model and like them making profits. So it's one reason why like kind of unions are kind of a better solution than government regulation in lots of places, because they can customize the terms of a collective bargaining agreement to the particular needs of that workplace and those workers.
So it's still the free market. It's just that there's some organization on one side.
Yeah, so you can think of it as the free – I don't know. I feel like most people that would say that it's the free market would say, well, if you have to negotiate collectively, then it's not free. But you kind of want it to be collective because you need that kind of balance of bargaining power on both sides. It has to be all the workers at once.
I mean, maybe there's another term for it's not the government doing it.
It's not the government doing it. It's decentralized, I would say. It's decentralized and it's bottom up.
Right.
But
it's
but it's not free market.
Mindscape listeners love to learn, but there's not enough Mindscape to fill the day, frankly. So you might want to consider The Great Courses Plus. This is a streaming service that gets you college-level courses directly to your home, whether it's your laptop, your mobile device, or whatever. You'll have access to the best professors from the best universities in the world with courses that cover all sorts of different topics, from history to languages to music to, of course, science. There's a wonderful course called Black Holes, Tides, and Curved Space-Time, Understanding Gravity. Gravity from Isaac Newton to Albert Einstein and beyond. I have my own courses that I've done on the Higgs boson, on time, on dark matter, dark energy. So you can unlock a world of knowledge with The Great Courses Plus. For Mindscape listeners, you can get a full month unlimited access for free if you sign up today using a special URL. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/Mindscape. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Mindscape for a full month of college courses all over the map for absolutely free.
Good. This raises a whole bunch of deeper things. We've successfully covered what I wanted to be the second half of the interview in the first half. So that's good. That's fine.
We can come back to the first half.
That's how we roll here in Mindscape. We just follow the flow of the river. I mean, the free market, capitalism. How do you feel about these things? How should we feel about these things? Let's be big picture and ask, you know, certainly there's been enormous successes. There's been dramatic failures. I feel that there are people who are very, very pro-free market, who love to bring up spectacular failures of central planning, and there
are plenty.
And there's exactly the opposite. There are people very anti-free market who love to bring up the spectacular failures of capitalism. And there's fewer people sort of talking to people who are close to them but slightly different, you know, across one divide. Do you have a big opinion about this stuff, or does the economics profession have big opinions about this stuff?
Yeah, no way. The economics profession does not. I think it's almost as like a condition of membership is not allowed to have an opinion about capitalism.
No, I thought you need to love capitalism.
Well, yeah, I generally it's like pro, but like it's the kind of thing that like, oh, we're trying to be scientific, we're just trying to study.
Right.
It's like
cosmologists being asked about the existence of God.
Yes. So a couple of things. One is no one should deny that like the success of capitalism in raising material standards of living has been kind of amazing and a world historical break. And, you know, Cosmo Schelezi, another SFI professor, has a great line, which is like the singularity already happened.
Yeah.
And it was the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And we basically let these eldritch forces loose. And one of those is kind of letting people buy and sell stuff at an arm's length transactions, and that kind of being a really great way to coordinate people's wants over very long distances.
People can look online. There's this charming short video with you in it where you're complaining about the lack of Wi-Fi on the train in London, and then you go, well, but then again, 800 years ago, they were, you know, dying of dysentery and eating gruel, so I shouldn't be complaining.
Exactly. So that's part of this textbook project, which we should talk about.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, what irritates me to no end is when anti-capitalists sort of somehow pretend that it was better before capitalists. So I have no sympathy for that argument.
Yeah, okay.
An argument I do have some sympathy for is that, you know, that's not the right counterfactual. The counterfactual we should always be thinking about is how does this performing relative to what some other thing that we could have. And so looking to the past doesn't generate the right counterfactual. What you want to think about is another possible future. Do there exist other like economic organizations, ways of organizing the economy that given the technologies that we have, that might actually be like a better fit and might result in more human flourishing, less inequality, more environmental sustainability, all of these good things that we want? Could we do better? And I feel like we don't do ourselves a lot of favors by pretending that the thing that we've got is the best that it could possibly be. And a friend of mine, Glenn Wallace, says it's like it's like an engineer looking at the telegraph and thinking, this has got to be the best way to communicate, guys. Like,
we perfected it. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got it. It's and so we should, as social scientists, as citizens, be thinking about doing things better. And so some of that is just policy fixes within the orbit of capitalism, and mm-hmm. we can talk about lots of those, and that's things like healthcare and like antitrust and like minimum wages, and some of them might involve like things that are kind of strike more to the core of what makes capitalism distinctive, which you can think of as like making private property a little bit more of an elastic concept. So you can imagine in an economy where the biggest resources are like ideas, that putting those in the shackles of private ownership and in patents and in monopoly rights is kind of not necessarily doing ourselves the best, giving ourselves the best chances of success.
Well, and these days when you can patent or copyright genes or algorithms and things like that, it seems bizarre to me. It seems like maybe that's exactly what you're saying. It's not a comfortable fit where
yes.
we to these concepts that were brought up in the context of, you know,
agriculture,
farms,
manufacturing, and
cows.
Yeah, or even like
or mills.
Trading widgets. And that when you have these goods that are like, you know, as Sam Bowles calls them, it's like fugitive resources. They're like a high fixed cost, zero marginal cost kinds of goods, that shackling them with the institutions of capitalism, maybe it's not a great fit. And
right.
then other people that are pro-capitalist will say, yes, that's what's been said at every technological change, is that capitalism is no longer a good fit. And what you'll always see is that it winds up sort of still doing a better job than any other system. So,
I mean, and because private property and property rights are like the central tenet.
They're definitely like a big part of it.
I mean, I do think let's just be a little pro-capitalist for a second.
Yep.
I think of it as a search strategy, right? You know, in some way, capitalism is a way to find a certain kind of equilibrium that has good properties. People are innovative. They try to do better. They have incentives pointing in the right direction. You know, what is your pro-capitalist sales pitch for someone who's never heard of it?
I think that's right. I think it's like the idea that you the way that you get prestige and status and material resources in capitalism is by making things that other people want to buy.
Yeah.
And that's a real break from like how human history did it before, which was like you killed lots of people or like or you conquered lots of territory or something. And so a real institutional break is making the basis of social reward providing useful things to like anonymous strangers.
So it's more of a win-win.
It's more of a win-win.
Yeah.
And
so
that's
benefit that, yourself by doing things to benefit
that's
other people.
Kind of, I mean, yeah. if you put it abstractly like that, it's like, what a great
sure.
thing. I think the limitations is that like there's other things that you can do that are really profitable under capitalism that don't involve yeah. making useful things for other people.
Well, I wanted to sort of talk about the term rent-seeking because
yep.
it's used as sort of an epithet, but I think probably most people in the street were like, you know, well, yeah, people own property and they rent it. What's
yeah.
wrong with that?
So we should back up and define concepts. So rent, technically in economics, is just defined as like a payment for something above and beyond its next best. It's payment that it would guess under its next best alternative. So, you know, I'm making rents as a professor. If I'd be willing to do this job for, you know, one-tenth the salary, and so then everything above that one-tenth of my current salary is rents.
Okay, that sounds like a bizarre
right?
construal of the
yeah.
word rent.
Yes, so that and it's not completely alien to the traditional use of like payments for land, because the idea was that an opportunity cost of land is zero. It just
yeah.
sits there,
and, okay.
And so that's why landlords are like often, you know, the worst people in history. It's like why they're like that.
We've all met them. Yes.
Yeah.
We've all had them.
It's just like you're and why they've often been called like social parasites is that you're just there's a pure landlord in pure form is just sitting there collecting rent while like the land that they own purely by virtue of a property right
yeah.
doesn't actually they're not actually doing anything to produce that value. And you can imagine in the real world they're developing and doing stuff, but that's not the pure landlord function. That's like a developer.
That's what I was
going
to say. Like, I mean, just to be fair, if there's any landlords, in fact, my friend Karen, if you're listening out there, you know, like, of course, real world people are often much better than just sitting in their in their home collecting the rent.
But I think conceptually you can split apart the
it's a different role.
Maintain the development and maintenance of a house with ownership rights of the land on top of that house.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's why it's like the opportunity cost of land, pure land, was zero, and so all the payments going to land were considered rent.
And somehow, it's become a way of conceptualizing a certain kind of bad behavior under capitalism, or a certain way it doesn't work. I don't know what to say.
Use that way. I mean, I think in core, in this textbook project, what we try to say is that, you know, this productive, an entrepreneur starting a new business, seeing that there's like some service that could be offered that's not being offered, and starting a business to do that, they're rent seeking. But because there's like a rent there that's like a gap between what the things that are that person's time and the cost of those materials and all of that and what they could be getting by producing this good and selling it. So they're getting a rent by supplying this market thing.
It doesn't sound like that's such a bad thing in that sense.
I think there's productive rent seeking in that, like, a lot of innovation and a lot of entrepreneurship is in fact chasing rents as a part of making the market work. And that's part of how markets work, is that people inside the market are like chasing rents all over the place and trying to meet people's needs and lower costs and things like that. And so there's a very we shouldn't prejudice the term rent seeking as necessarily a bad thing, although I think when it is used in a prejudiced way, it's often referred to kind of like artificially raising barriers to entry, engaging in the kind of activities that are like zero sum, so that you're like trying to like raise your share of a pie at the expense of someone else's rather than trying to grow a pie. But I think that's how it's used in a pejorative way. But I think conceptually we can sort of say it's just like trying to get a flow of income that's higher than your opportunity cost. And just to put a pin in it, that opportunity cost is a pretty metaphysical idea, so it's very we say rents very casually, but actually operationalizing what's a rent and what isn't is
this is an issue. I think it's an issue in physics as well, where we use words like energy and dimension and time in a different way than people use them on the street. In economics, we also use words and struggle over their definitions. There's a very related word I wanted to get to that I know you and other people were feisty about on Twitter recently, namely neoliberalism. And of course, it starts with the word liberalism, but then it's neo. And I think that maybe it goes back to Reagan and Thatcher era things, but some people use it to mean Bill Clinton and Tony Blair.
Yeah.
And some people just use it to mean everything good or everything bad.
So I find as a very clear statement of it is a 1950 article by Milton Friedman, where he actually just literally explains what the doctrine of neoliberalism is. And it's not libertarianism, importantly. It is not just
the
like—
libertarianism would be the more pure free market.
The more pure free market. No need for a state,
laisez-faire,
even. Like, we don't even need police, for
or
example.
The night watchman? No,
well, so I think the night watchman state might be on the outer edges of neoliberalism. And but then, you know, in Milton Friedman's article, he really does talk about like the functions of government should be to not distort the market.
Yeah.
And but that also means that it needs to provide like antitrust and might need to do some sort of basic income provision.
A universal basic income.
Yeah, so I don't think he uses the term, but I think he's not unopposed to the idea that the government's doing some non-distortionary redistribution. But what
Milton Friedman, radical leftist.
Well, yeah, but I think it's a very important, and this is sort of where we started with that, like Econ 103 and Econ 104, is that the broad view of neoliberalism is like the open markets is just like free money, and it's just always like going to be it's both good for prosperity, it's fair on its own rights. Like what you get in the market is pretty close to what you might deserve.
Yeah.
And we might need to fix it like with these very particular tools. Like we might need to, in some places, make it a little bit more competitive, or we might need to undo the worst excesses of it by redistributing to the poor. But the idea that you would like broadly have to have the government intervene in a variety of places inside the economy was like they were like no, and in you know so in particular like you know regulations and things like that were mm-hmm. like seen as not particularly necessary because you know the market would fix it.
But I guess I'm still a little unclear, and this is why.
Yeah, let's talk through it.
And so I don't think that the word should even be used because people mean different things by it.
But let me give you I think a very clear, which is just this broad confidence in markets as the baseline right. mechanism for organizing the production of
but I guess what I want to get at, if the government passes a rule that, you know, is sort of a safety standards for factories,
yep.
does that distort the market?
Yes.
So explain why.
Yeah, so like, I mean, imagine, let's take a ridiculous example.
I'm trying to contrast yep. that with like literal central planning that says, you know, here is the cost of this good.
Yep. Because we can come up with ridiculous regulations, and
sure, okay.
And so there's some regulations a good example is zoning restrictions in California. Where you know endless numbers of people have pointed out how like these restrictions on where and what you can build are causing all these other problems. And so, you know, there's a very neoliberal take on that, which is like get rid of them. There's like a less confident and less articulate thing, which is that, well, some of them might be there for a reason, and we can't just necessarily presume that they're all bad because they are restrictions on markets, that there's some restrictions on markets that are, in fact, good, even though they are distorting. And even though they are like deviations from this, a more efficient benchmark, because of either the kinds of communities that they support, because of the political coalitions they allow, because of something else, potentially non-economic, and that's an argument that we can have is you know the neo.
So beginning to get it in the sense that. Something like a safety regulation or a zoning restriction counts as a distortion of the market because it's saying here's something you can't do in the market.
Here's some voluntary, mutually improving transaction that we, the government, will say that you cannot do.
Right, because I could build a really, really deadly factory and people might want to work in it, and the government's saying you can't do that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Got it.
And my favorite, just to come back to, it's like my favorite example of like a bit of the Constitution that like rules out some of this is actually the 13th Amendment, which says that I'm literally not allowed to indenture myself. I cannot.
Even though you'd willingly,
even though I might be willing,
transaction.
And that was very conscious at the time because there was like Mexican peons in New Mexico, in the New Mexico territory that were in debt bondage, and you know that was one of the things that was coming up was like, are they covered under the 13th Amendment because they had voluntarily?
So you have issues with neoliberalism.
Yeah, I guess so. I think it's also like kind of one of these things that's way past its sell-by date. It was also just like when I just think of the origins of so many of the kind of social problems that we've got now, I just feels in my it just feels like the history is kind of borne out that a lot of those can be laid at the feet of policy reforms that were conducted in the name of neoliberalism in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and even up and through the Bush and Obama administrations. So that's why that ideological label is – some people see it as so elastic, but some people say it's like, no, there was a real tendency and a real commonality that went through all of those administrations, and this is the name that we give to it.
And one of the things – this is just my physics prejudice showing through, but one of the things that fascinates me is the relationship of various economic doctrines, capitalism and nihilism. Neoliberalism, for example, to time, right? And one of the big counterarguments against neoliberalism or capitalism maybe is that it has led to disasters of climate change because of tragedy of the commons kind of things. And we need to move beyond this sort of just adjust to what the market wants if we're going to serve future generations. But then But then there's a big philosophy question. Like, on the one hand, how much do we owe to future generations? And on the other hand, previous guest Astra Taylor brings up this question of why do we pay so much attention to the wishes of previous generations when people, you know, have their wills that are distributed in certain ways or inheritances in
undead trust funds.
Yeah. is there a way that has this been properly theorized, the relationship of economics to future and past generations?
So there has been a lot of theory about, you know, so here's an intuition from economics that probably other people haven't thought of, is that one of the things that you also get is that future generations are also going to be richer than us just because of technological change. And
one hopes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And so for any given level of climate change, you know, there's some ways in which, like, future generations might be actually better off, might have more tools to deal with it, or in any case might be richer. And so some, I mean, I'm not going to – I don't necessarily think this, but there's some arguments for saying that if you are going to do this trade-offs across generations, you might want to also take account of the kind of income inequality across generations, because we are poorer than our future than future generations are going to be. So maybe we've earned a little right to
unless we destroy the planet.
Unless we destroy the planet. So
richer.
It's a good that you said that, because it puts a finger on, like, a real deficiency of the way economists think about things, which is that we're always thinking in terms of, like, smooth optimization problems.
Yeah.
And so there's, like, oh, there's always some margin on which you could, like, shift a little bit more here versus there. But if you're dealing with these systems that have these big nonlinearities and cliffs and things like that, then that kind of, like, thinking at the margin that economists are kind of trained to do doesn't work super well.
It's less appropriate.
It's less appropriate, yeah. And so that's, I think, like, a pretty deep, I think, criticism of economics, is that this like, really focus on thinking about what you can do at the margin, where you have these kind of – you can always move a little bit from choice A to choice B, and so you just have to pick in between them, fails when you're just like, nope, it's like a big gap in payoffs, and so you need some other decision calculus to account
for
that.
I mean, that's the opposite of, I guess, Tyler Cowen was a previous guest on the podcast, and he has this point of view that the best thing to do, the morally best action, is just to maximize economic growth.
Yep.
Because compound interest, right? You know, it catches up. And also, we should not discount future generations at all. They're people just like us. I made him slightly disgruntled by calling him the temporal version of Peter Singer.
Peter Singer says
we should count people far away just as much, and he's counting future people. But I think it makes sense to me to discount future generations because of so much uncertainty about what things will be like. Like, what? How can we possibly think that we're accurately judging what the future generations are going to have or not have?
Yeah, so I think the uncertainty makes it complicated. But, you know, then you get into these, like, insane kind of calculations that effective altruism people kind of do of, like, the risk of AI. So basically, once you start discounting for enough in the future,
we have to do them.
Sorry,
they're insane, but we also have to do them in some sense.
So we do have to do them, but I think the idea that you can it feels like you're doing a lot of like division by small numbers. And so you can make small quantities blow up by dividing by, like, a really, really small number.
Or you're multiplying really big numbers by really small numbers.
Yes, or
you can get any number you want.
Right. So you're in that space with a lot of these future discounting calculations. It feels like, again, the tools of, like, trying to think about the trade-offs aren't really well suited to that, because the scales are just, like, up in the air, so we just have no idea what the magnitudes are. So, like, thinking quantitatively about trade-offs at, you know, 10 generations from now, I'm not sure it's super productive.
So I take your point that there's sort of an attitude that says that future generations will, on the one hand, be better equipped, and on the other hand, know more about what the situation is, so maybe they should handle it.
But I also think it's moot for climate change. Like, we're here now. I'm like, my life is materially worse because of climate change. It's like,
I live in California.
So I feel like all of this, like, oh, how much should we wait the generations of the future? It's done. That was the 15 years ago conversation. And, like,
right. Okay, fair enough. But I like the analogy of inequality of, you know, the present to the future, because, you know, so let's go back to the present, and there's inequality now, and this has been a longstanding thing among economists, right? You know, they measure progress by GDP or something like that, and less by how the worst off people are doing. Is there more? Am I crazy in thinking there seems to be more attention now paid to issues of inequality?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. A Nobel laureate in my first year of grad school, 2004, at Berkeley, I went, I was like, I'm interested in studying inequality. And he was very smart. He said, he's like, you know, nobody really cares about studying inequality. Except the French. The French really like studying inequality. And he was absolutely right about one of those things. That's but I think obviously that's changed. I think Occupy Wall Street played some role. I think Bernie Sanders, I think the actual just continuing increase of inequality has done its own work.
Let that go by too quickly. It is fairly agreed upon that in the last some number of years, and maybe you should tell me rather than me guessing, inequality has been increasing.
Yeah. No, I think nobody can deny that inequality has increased over the last like 40 years.
Yeah.
In the US, I think people will argue, in the US, in the UK, in almost everywhere, although the magnitude of the increase is much muted in the continental countries. People will argue about exactly how much, and like you can, there are calculations you can do that kind of get you a range that looks like, oh, it wasn't so bad, or it was enormous.
But it's gone up more in the more neoliberal countries.
Yes, it has gone up more in the more Anglo countries, almost for sure. It's also gone up a lot, though, in developing countries. So countries that have grown a lot, like
India. I said neoliberal countries.
I think that's that. So one of the interesting, I think, recent areas of research is the stuff pursued by Piketty and Saez and Zucman that's kind of come out of that whole French research program, which is the idea of distributional national accounts, which is that instead of just keeping track of like the aggregate GDP of a country, let's keep track of it by percentile.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you get an easy statistic. It's just look at median GDP instead of like mean. Right. Will just get you like pretty much the sense in which the 50th percentile is doing, and that's like not a bad proxy for also capturing how evenly distributed the growth is.
And it's a nice kind of marketing ploy, because no one can argue with collecting more data or paying attention to more data, right?
Well, people can
argue. It's not like, normative.
So you'd be – because like again, just like it comes in with the national accounts, you can – a lot of folk theory goes into the construction of the measures. Mm. And so you have to argue a lot – on both sides, lots of people are arguing about what are the folk theories that are going into constructing these statistics. Okay. And so that's where there's like an active argument on Twitter and things like that. And so
choosing what to pay attention to is a big choice.
Exactly. It's and what assumptions you make about allocating dollars and things, it's gets into the weeds and it matters.
Okay, but anyway, inequality is increasing.
Yep.
Probably we should do something about that. I mean, I guess people's opinions will differ.
I think there's lots of people that think like, no, we shouldn't do anything but inequality. We should just fix poverty.
Yeah.
Lots of people think that.
What do you think?
I think you don't get a flourishing society with like insane amounts of inequality. Like,
so let's just again lay it out there. You know, there's certainly, I think that my youthful self would have been guilty of saying, look, if everyone is better off, it doesn't matter that some people are way better off, it's still better, right?
Yep.
So is there an intrinsic value to equality?
I just think there's lots of dimensions of things that are important that are in fact zero sum.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have this kind of like, and it's things, even if just something very basic, like relative status in society is basically kind of a thing that you, because it's relative, it's got to be zero sum. And so when you have enormous income inequality and it's roughly correlated with this, it means that some people have very low status. And that's just not great for like a good, healthy, democratic society. That's itself is like a reason. Once you have some things that are zero sum that are correlated with that come along with income inequality, that's a good reason to reduce the income inequality. And so that those zero sum things can include relative status, they can include political power, they can include like cultural representation in society. There's a bunch of things that are not just expanding the pie, but where the distribution of the pie really like means that some people are made worse off.
And is the solution to this as simple as changing the tax code, wealth taxes or inheritance taxes or just a more progressive tax system?
I hope so, because the only other thing is like we either do it through policy. Like here's the bet is that the only way in which we've seen inequality of this type like fall in the past is with like social catastrophes.
Yeah, okay.
And like it's either an internal revolution or it's external war. I mean, Walter Schneidel has a book, The Great Leveler, that kind of makes this point. But here's the bet, which is that we are progressed enough as a society, as a civilization. We have enough tools of government and enough tools of reason in the society that we can actually use policy to reduce inequality without having to go through a war.
Right. That's the bet/hope/aspiration.
Yeah,
right?
And that's one of the reasons for like thinking about the goals is like a wealth tax and these things. It's like, look, guys, we don't have to, you know, worry about millions of dead people. If we can actually get these like relatively mild policy things into play, and you can imagine the same similar with climate change. It's like, you know, one way or another, like the climate is going to like fix us.
Yeah. But the human brain just isn't meant to think, to reason on these timescales, right? I mean, if someone is very wealthy right now and has never seen a revolution in their lifetime, the prospect just doesn't seem real to them, right? They would rather keep their money.
Maybe it's for their own good that we'll take it from them. but, you know, I think that's the thing. It's like, yeah, they will fight it. And hopefully the idea is that that doing it through the democratic process is a way to get it peacefully to do it, like, while maintaining democratic institutions. And so,
I mean, we've certainly seen the eyes grow wide among the cohort of wealthy Democratic donors at the prospect that Elizabeth Warren could get nominated and start taxing their wealth.
Yep.
Right?
I mean, good. It's good. I mean, I think it's
Someone said on Twitter, you know, if the rest of us had as much class solidarity as the billionaires do, we'd be better off.
I mean, they call each other on the phone and tell each other to run.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things about the wealth inequality thing that I think Piketty and others have sort of made kind of apparent is that, which is actually something I learned at Santa Fe Institute a long time ago, which is this idea of like Jabrot's law for wealth, that like basically because assets have these like stochastic multiplicative returns, so they just kind of grow at a random rate, that can get you like an extremely skewed like power law distribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
These
power laws are just very natural outcomes of sort of networked processes building on each other.
Yeah, cumulative processes. Yeah. I think that, and
that explains why like a good old revolution is the best way to increase equality.
Wait, that is the other way you get it. Or you can think that what you do is you damp down the growth parameter, and so you're like kind of you're never going to get rid of it, but you can like slow by taxing wealth, you're kind of curbing that growth that's happening every year, and sort of letting, you know, it'll still like get out into like a power law, but just the thinness of the tail will be less. It's
okay. So the sales pitch to the wealthy donors is you'd rather have a wealth tax than the guillotine.
Yeah. I mean, I think they know that at some level.
I
think at another level, they're like, this isn't the society they themselves grew up in.
Yeah.
And I think they feel some of them at least might feel some guilt for that.
I mean, at a more practical level, do you have a favorite strategy? Maybe wealth taxes serve some purpose, but there's other things to do also.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, I think something like the labor movement has to come back. And both for political reasons, because it was a way for so many regular people to have their voices aggregated, to be expressed politically. It trained so many working class people to like run for office. It was just like this broad based kind of institution that when in the 50s had 35% of the American workforce in it, that just did a lot to like compress the income distribution. And I think when I think of what I'm sort of like committed to is trying to figure out how to use social science and things to help sort of resuscitate something that looks like a labor movement.
Are you personally in favor of basic income?
I think not really, actually. I mean, it's an interesting idea to play with. I wouldn't be opposed if we got it. But I do think there's a way in which we'll, see a lot of the gains undone by like monopoly pricing. And secondly, that there's like a real sense in which work and like the fact of having to go and interact productively with people that are not like you is just like a real great glue for.
But don't you think? I mean, I'm completely open to this possibility. My mind is very open about UBI, and I'm glad that certain local jurisdictions are experimenting with it because we can collect the data, right? But I think almost everyone will still work, even if they have that a might basic be, income. Right?
In which case, then so I think that's fine. I mean, then it just becomes like it's not actually a transformation of society in any way. Well, it's just like a little extra cash.
You raise the floor for the people who don't.
You raise the floor, but if you're not raising the floor enough to get some people to like opt out of the to people opt out, then you're not raising the floor that much.
Yeah, maybe. I'm literally thinking of people on Skid Row in Los Angeles that who could afford a studio apartment if there were UBI.
So I think there's a lot of that. I also would my optimist side would also think that a lot of the other pathologies and like pain that comes with being poor would be less if you were just less poor. And so
giving people money,
not a bad idea.
And it is expensive. I get it.
So. It's not that. I mean, you could do a UBI. Maybe not like this year, but like in 10 years, American society could easily afford like a reasonable UBI. In fact, there's a very easy way to do it right now, which is just take the earned income tax credit that we already do, then just like so my friend Aaron Dubay proposed this, of just like make it so that you don't get zero if you're not working. You're just getting some positive amount. But then if you work more, you get even more via the EITC. And so then that disincentivizes, people get a basic income, but there's still some additional incentives to work. And so that might actually be both the kind of the best of both worlds.
All right, it's time to wrap up. I want to give you an opportunity to promote at least two different things. One is the idea of economics for inclusive prosperity. Yep. Did I get that right?
Yep. So here, the idea of that was me and Danny Roderick and Gabriel Zucman were at a conference with intellectual historians and sociologists. It was at CASPIS at Stanford, and it was kind of about neoliberalism, and all of these other social scientists were like, economics is responsible for neoliberalism. And we were like, what are you talking about? And basically, so we started this initiative to kind of just collect policy ideas and get like a group of economists that were kind of doing progressive policy that were kind of doing work in progressive policy circles, but it just wasn't getting heard in either policymakers or even other social sciences. And so we're like, let's put up this flag that just suggests that there is, in fact, like at least a community of economists that are non-neoliberal.
And, well, a good branding goes a long way.
A good branding goes,
letting people know.
and see what comes up. And so that was kind of and we've gotten some really, I mean, some of the policy memos are really fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's also giving people like economists that have really great ideas
What does it mean? Inclusive prosperity.
Oh, like, I mean, it's a generic nice thing. It's like who could be against inclusive prosperity?
Exactly, right.
But the idea that like the economic growth, it's not enough to just consider the level of economic growth. You also want to consider its distribution, and you don't just want to consider like economic growth narrowly as GDP. You want to consider the broad measures of human flourishing.
That idea, which
you talked about. Yeah. And the price of entry is kind of one of these like 5 to 10 page policy memos that kind of like builds on your research or something you've worked on and sort of talks about like an idea for either a policymaker to run with or just kind of a view on a way to make the world better. And so these policy briefs that have come back have been kind of really fantastic and really really interesting. So I just encourage everyone to go check it out at econfip.org.
All right, we will link to it in the show notes.
Okay, and what was the other thing you wanted me to?
Well, sorry, before we go on the other thing, it does remind me. I wanted to just ask a little bit about the duty that you have as a social scientist or an economist in particular. I mean, there was just a conference in Santa Fe. I don't know if you were there.
No, I missed it. Yeah,
it seemed to be from the live tweeting. There seemed to be a lot of ragging on economists on the basis of abandoning their social responsibilities. Jeffrey West said, like, why aren't economists leading the battle against climate change? And so I've always thought that it's perfectly okay to be a scientist, even a social scientist, who just tries to describe what happens in the world. But it's also okay as a field, there might be an obligation to intervene constructively in some ways.
So what is okay? So what's the social obligation of economists?
Well, I don't know. Is that so what I'm you're asking me? If you think that there is one. I mean, do you think that if
do no harm?
Well, yeah, okay. Do no harm would be a good one. I mean, I guess the argument I buy is that there are experts who have a certain kind of special expertise, and if it's clear that that particular kind of expertise could be deployed to make the world a better place, then at least some fraction of people who have that expertise should do that.
I think that's true. And I think that does happen. I mean, I think you'll find that economists are much more involved in policymaking than physicists, almost any other social science. and some of them are, I think, like real like working on climate change, like my colleagues here work on climate change all the time. I don't know that we have more of a responsibility than the physicists.
neither do I. I think that the philosophy that I just outlined, which is, and I don't necessarily hold very strongly. I'm just trying to figure it out myself, but. I think that for the most part, academics, intellectuals, scholars should try to say true things about the world. But there, that's right next to doing good things in the world, and I admit that there's a connection there.
I would be happy if we just restricted ourselves to saying true things about the world. Okay. So, it's partly that the field has been so it's ideologically driven in a way most fields are not. Partly it's ideologically driven because there's actual conservatives in economics in the way that there aren't in like lots of other fields.
Right.
And so there are actually like political disagreements, and they're often – so I have a paper on this, how like you can actually predict using the language of an academic article. You can like do a pretty good job of predicting someone's campaign contributions.
Interesting.
And in economics because there's
because it really reveals some of their values in some sense.
Yeah. Right? So there's like and so you're going to have people – with diverging values inside the same discipline. And I don't know that the discipline should say, like, no, everybody should be doing if you have these divergent values and real disagreements over things.
Well, but I mean, the valence goes either way. Like, if someone legitimately believes that there's something that would make the world a better place, the question is then, whatever that thing is that they think would make the world a better place, is there some obligation to do it? I don't think that there's a sort of individual level obligation, but maybe there is a discipline-wide obligation.
Yeah, so I think if the discipline agreed on what those things were, it would be decent.
That's
but I don't know
fair.
That we agree.
Right. And the other thing was you mentioned a textbook.
Oh, yeah. So I'm part of this big open – me and Sam Bowles and others many other people in the circle of Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Institute, have been for a long time involved in a textbook project called CORE. It's core-econ.org. And it's basically a big online open source textbook that's not just like a usual way of teaching – it's aimed to be an introduction to economics textbook, but it really sort of presents – introductory economics in a way that's really different from every other textbook. And every other textbook is kind of the same to each other. Yeah. And what we're really trying to do is trying to say that like economics is not just supply and demand. It's not just the frictionless model. And so how we try to teach it, and Simon DeDeo, another SFI person, drew the analogy that CORE is kind of to traditional economics what the Feynman lectures were to like the physics teaching of the day, which was like, to like grab sort of the things that are happening on the research frontier and make them intelligible and useful to like people that are encountering it for the first time. With the idea that if you're never going to take another economics class, should you think the world looks like the frictionless model, or should you get this kind of like library of gadgets for thinking about the world?
All right, that's good. Is it out?
It's out. It's online. And you can just go and look at it. You can order it from OUP, from Oxford University Press. It's a
like a real book,
a real
actual
book.
Paper
yes.
book.
Yep.
Not
yep.
just okay.
Yeah,
very
it's
good.
Also online. It will always be online and for free. But if you also want, it's a.
I'm a big believer in real books as well. All right, Suresh Naidu, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Great.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.